Well, this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and that's our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself, with some great messages about respecting ourselves and others. I'm host Sheldon Brown, and Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. Well, heartbreaking news with the release of the latest suicide statistics. The Minister of Health is describing the figures as heartbreaking. The increase is 17 from 668 to 685. Our guest today, I've just asked her whether she would be prepared to comment on suicide. Our guest is the Professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Auckland, Dr. Tracy McIntosh. Tracy, not good news.
Tēnā koe, Sheldon. I mean, devastating news, and it really does speak to the types of devastating landscapes that we have out there for so many people, both at that individual level, at a whānau level, at a community level. You know, to think about these numbers, to think about what that means in terms of the impact on family, on whānau, the impact of parents who lose a child, of children who lose a parent, of people who lose a grandparent, you know, just what it means and the ramifications of it, the implications of it, the resonance of it, just constantly re-embedded. So when we try to think about New Zealand, and this is one of the things that I, you know, right across the board, why in a country of really significant abundance, why in a country where we have where there are things, you know, access to things that are wonderful, why do we have these suicide rates? Why do we have our poverty rates? Why do we have our incarceration rates? You know, so that's where we really have to look deep into the nation's psyche.
Well, many of the media commentators this morning seem to be you know, blaming social media, blaming poverty, blaming lack of housing, high costs. I guess it is a whole scenario, isn't it? It's not just one factor that contributes.
No, and it's that really high. I mean, every suicide is an individual event, but it has, you know, incredible, as I noted already, the impact, but also the ramifications of that. You know, when we think of the loss of far too many of our young men, and then we sort of think about the incredible numbers of our young women who attempt suicide. You know, so the parasuicide figures amongst young women, incredibly high. So all of those elements speak to you know, what we need in terms of connection. How do we really get community flourishing? You know, I often talk about collective security, an ability to have trust in the world, ability to recognize that there are difficult things out there, but you can trust the world. You can trust the world to get you through these things. And for far too many of our people, their ability to trust their own world, their social world, and that broader world is just too difficult. So the levels of isolation that are experienced in terms of our isolation to ourselves, and the ability for other people to connect to us. You know, we have to constantly look. That's when you strengthen communities, I truly believe that then you strengthen our ability to absolutely help each other. For me, our primary ethic as humans is in regards to our relationship with the other. And that relationship is not just with those that we love. This is a much broader sense of our humanity is in our recognition, that the recognition of all others and our responsibility to those others.
Well, I think the responsibility is to try and cultivate those connections. And I'm only, at my age, recognising how important that is and how important it is not to get offside with people that I've invested time with, you know, and be kind and gentle to them and compassionate and accepting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, research has told us, but we actually do this in our everyday life. The triggers that might lead to a suicidal event are often really quite minor. There may be much broader things in play, but the actual triggers. And this can be, you know, this can be an incredible sort of burden that we might feel, the thinking that I might say something offhand or I might, by omission, not do something. And I think that we do have to reflect on it. But the other side of it is the triggers to well-being, the importance of actually legitimating an individual for their feelings, being able to value them, those are already small. So our acts of kindness can create huge difference in the world. Yes. And I think that's one of the things, both in terms of this, both this burden in regards to the world, but also the incredible opportunities to truly see people in particular ways, really opens up those opportunities for ourselves. So we have to recognize that we can be agents of powerful transformative change.
Mm. One of the keys, I think, is the skill of listening.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word trust. I've got something here from Facebook saying, a bird sitting on a tree is never afraid of the branch breaking because her trust is not on the branch but on its own wings. Always believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, that's been a bit of a departure for our program today, because we're talking about an initiative to overhaul the criminal justice system that's taken a big step forward with the release of an interim report called He Waka Roimata, produced by a group called the Safe and Effective Justice Advisory Group. Its report has a special section on mental health, addiction and drug and alcohol abuse. One of its members, who is our guest and who has already been introduced, is Dr. Tracy McIntosh of University of Auckland. Tracy holds controversial views about our prisons and the criminal justice system and is seeking whānau-friendly alternatives to incarceration. So it's a bit late to welcome you to Take It From Us now. You've already made a major contribution, but how long has the He Waka Roimata report taken to produce?
So we met together. So we were brought together by Minister Little, though we are an independent group. And, you know, within that group, we hold a range of, we draw on experience, we have a range of diverse views, and we've been together 13 months now, and actually our second report is just coming up to completion, and that will be released to the prisoner very that's a beautiful Freudian slip, released to the minister released to the minister and very, very shortly, and I guess released to the public sometime after that.
So the whole consultation process and that sort of thing is completed now?
Yes.
There's no opportunity for others to comment on this report?
Well, I think one of the big things about this report, and actually in our terms of reference, was to start a conversation. And so the whole point of He Waka Roimata and the next report as well is to continue to embed. So there are recommendations that come out of the second report. The first report, the one that we'll be discussing today, that was very much about what we heard. The second report has a range of recommendations. What also comes out as a clarion call there is absolutely the need, just as in terms with the suicide conversation, the need to have that this conversation is really ongoing.
The conversation about the review of the criminal justice system and particularly alternatives to prison.
Yes, I mean, the Minister of Justice has a Hapaiatia program, which is a broader safe and effective justice group. We sit as an independent group within it. So that they will continue to be responding to both our reports. We've also had the report that came out of the Māori Justice Hui, Naya Tonune, and we've had the victims' reports come out as well. So there's a significant range of work, of people's voices coming through. We have to recognise that people themselves are experts of their own condition, and if we are going to be able to respond to this, we're going to have to learn to recognise them as expertise and draw on their knowledge to transform our system.
Well, we've also had the inquiry into mental health addictions, which was a major report, yes. 40 recommendations, 38 of which I think have been taken up by the government. One of them, of course, is to have no target for suicide reduction, and the Prime Minister was commenting again, and she didn't feel that that was going to contribute to this issue of suicide, but we won't get diverted.
And there is another report as well that came out, which I also was actually involved in, and that was the report out of the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, the Whakamana Tangata report, and really there the underlying theme is dignity. about ensuring that all of our processes, all of our structures treat everyone with dignity, that the restoration of mana is one of the most important things that we can do.
Well, I'd have to say that my occasional experiences in acute psychiatric care certainly didn't involve too much dignity.
That's right.
And, you know, because of my age, I was placed in a unit, in the most recent occasion, where most of the patients were demented, and that doesn't lead to an atmosphere of therapy or recovery.
Yeah. So absolutely, at that base then is this notion around the restoration of mana for that we regards to other people, but also within the system. You know, what you're speaking about is something that's systems driven. It's not people centred, and the real need for us to be able to do that. And I absolutely believe, you know, we're a population of 4.5 million people. We can absolutely show global leadership in this area. That's my belief.
Right. Well, maybe we need to grow up a little bit as people, because I do think that we are intensely fearful of embarrassing the people that we're with, and therefore I don't think we always ask the questions that need to be asked.
Yeah,
you know, so
we stick
with the safe things, with the families, with our material possessions in terms of our conversation, but we don't dig deeper.
Yes.
And until we do, I firmly believe that these issues are going to prevail.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, so does in your view, does this report, the Hewaka Roimata report, which you say is the first of two reports coming out, so the second one is due out fairly soon?
Very soon, yes. So this first report then, you know, the vessel of tears, Hewaka Roimata, you know, really speaks to the landscape of grief that we encountered in our consultations throughout the country. And the second report then is much more looking at some sort of really high-level recommendations that we'll make in terms of setting a platform for transformation. So I think with why He Waka Roimata is really important, because it truly is what we heard. Now, we spoke to many, many people, and obviously you want to be able to distill what people have said but not dilute it. And recognizing that there's a whole range of views out there, but whether people had been harmed or whether people had harmed, that grief was apparent.
So the grief, who among the community that you've spoken to are expressing this grief?
So this is the thing that we found, that this grief, this sense that about the damage that the present system has done, that was found by those who were victims, and that was found by those who had harmed others. So that was the overwhelming, it's why we came through this sort of sense around, if I think about the overwhelming emotion that we encountered, it was this one of grief. And many of that was within the mental health domain. Whānau members that had sought help, that had done everything within their power to get help for another family member, were unable to do that, faced really significant barriers and obstacles, and that family member either harmed themselves or harmed others. Recognition of the types of statistics that we see within our prisons, where we actually have more people with complex mental health issues within our prisons than we do in our mental health system.
So let's ask that question. You know, many reports suggest that at least 90% of prison inmates, even as high as perhaps 99% of prison inmates, have mental health challenges. I mean, in your view, is that statistic accurate?
When I spend a lot of time in prisons, you know, I'm in a prison usually on a weekly basis, and I've been doing that for a long time, so I have a lot of experience, and I work a lot with people who have also been in and out, churning through the prison system. And I think that statistic, as horrifying as it is a very close to the reality. And I think, you know, we sort of, within the last 12 months, I think the statistic is around 62% of people who are presently incarcerated in the prior 12 months had had a mental health incident, sort of seen as 91% over life course, very high levels of women, over 50%, with post-traumatic stress disorder, high amongst our men as well. So really high rates of, you know, it's such a significant issue. And as I said, we have more people churning through the system with these very complex mental health needs than we actually see within our mental health system.
So if a woman has post-traumatic stress disorder and perhaps that leads to some sort of criminal activity and she ends up in prison, she still has that post-traumatic stress disorder and she's in prison. I mean, what worse environment could you be in for that sort of diagnosis?
Well, I think the thing is that we do have to recognise that prisons are coercive institutions. So, you know, that's really an operating principle of it. People are in there mostly not wishing to be in there, so there's always a level of coercion for women and for wahine Māori who are in prison. Then that element of coercive control is often a characteristic that they've had outside of the prison as well, and so reinforcing that type of thing, you know, I mean, I've said it many times, these are on the whole anti-therapeutic environments. That is not to say there are some really interesting things that I've seen happening in prison, in many ways in an indictment of the broader society. So for some people, it's the first time that they're able to actually access
Therapy,
just mental health care on a regular basis. For some people, it's the first time, particularly around any type of medication regime, that they're able to access that and they're actually able to stabilise it. So I have had people who have said to me their real concerns on release about their ability to maintain that, you know, because of access issues, because of sometimes a real apathy to particular people with such complex needs that also then have convictions and a prison record. So there are those other elements in there. There are people within a prison environment that do get access to therapy. They're a very small number given the numbers who go through. We have a very large remand population in New Zealand. A remand population on the whole have never had access to a whole range of things. And it's a very volatile environment, as you can imagine, because what you get in a remand, you get people who may have been arrested today and remanded straight to prison, you've got people who've never been in a prison environment before having to deal with a, you know, very difficult situation. Usually they've got issues in their personal life that they don't know how are going to be resolved now they're here. Then you've got other people who are very used to churning through the system, very comfortable within that system, and who navigate it in ways that make it difficult for others. So This is the reality of a prison environment. We have had out this week, there's lots of things coming out at the moment, Sheldon, as you can see, the Hokairangi report, which is the new Māori strategy by corrections. And for all of us, even those of us who are often, you know, play that role of critic, this is quite an astonishing strategy. And one of its main dimensions is humanizing and healing. And there is something about seeing a report coming out of corrections that has a lot of words in it that are really supportive, but that healing and humanising. Mm. So I think we have to read a whole lot of those things. You know, as I said, now it is up to us to ensure that that strategy is implemented and that that dimension is as well as the right to cultural identity. It's not just a privilege that's given out in a privilege economy, it's a right to know who we are and why we are where we are, so that we can create changes in our lives.
So those two words, humanising and
healing.
Is that the first time that you've seen those sorts of words?
Certainly within that dimension as well, and it's certainly not to say that corrections hasn't within other documents recognise the issue of mental health, because they have. It's impossible not to within that environment. But this strategy, and for your listeners, do have a look at it. It is available online, Hokairangi, the corrections new Māori strategy, which I hope will become the lead strategy for corrections, not just for Māori, but for everyone to be encompassed by this strategy. And it will demand huge cultural and institutional change within corrections.
Well, we'll just take a music break. We're playing The Dudes. I think The Dudes got back together again in 2006 for a special celebration. It may have, in fact, been to mark the 40th birthday of Radio Hauraki, and we've got a track called On the Rocks.
Here's a song called On the Rocks.
That's The Dudes with On the Rocks. This is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and I'm host Sheldon Brown. Today we're talking to one of the members of the Safe and Effective Justice Advisory Group, which has produced the first of two reports, which I understand are both directed at overhauling the criminal justice system. Our guest today is Dr. Tracy McIntosh, who is Professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Auckland. And Tracy, you mentioned remand, and I'm a bit ignorant about prison, I suppose. So every prison has a remand section.
Yeah, most prisons would have a remand section. Not all of them would. Some of the ones down would be. So remand means you've been accused, but you have not been convicted or sentenced. So you're only accused. And it's because of that nature and the presumption of innocence, even though you've been remanded, that means that often they don't get the sorts of access that others who are incarcerated would.
So to go back to that woman with post-traumatic stress disorder, she's charged, she's remanded in custody, she still has her diagnosis. How traumatic could that be for somebody like that?
For many people, that's a very, very difficult. As I said, I often find it the most volatile space within it. And, you know, I do want to make it clear, there's often a real push to always talking about prisons is always really dangerous, and I often think that one of the real characteristics of prisons is actually boredom, but there is this volatility. Things can happen and they can happen very quickly. And what you find, you know, we know already the impacts of toxic stress, and it's very difficult to think of a prison without thinking about the accumulation of stress that you find within that environment. So some people are also, if they've been arrested and remanded, they may be coming off drugs. They may be, you know, in terms of their overall well-being is really poor, let alone their mental health. So within that environment, coming into a place, if you've got, you know, if we're thinking about that woman, she may have children. In fact, she's very likely to. She's got to worry about where they are, what's happening to them, what's happening with others. You know, you're not able to, you know, often you're not able to make that, you know, it's hard to make the telephone calls. You don't have people's numbers. One of the things that you lose straight away is your cell phone. And I don't know, Sheldon, I can remember back in the day when you actually knew a whole lot of phone numbers in your head.
Right.
You know, even
not anymore.
No, even people who I love very much, I don't know their numbers. You know, even my husband, I don't know his number. I just push his name on my phone. So, you know, so this is one of the real things. When you no longer have your phones and others, actually being able to contact people can often be very difficult. Plus, for other people, there's a sense of shame. There's a sense of if they've been in these positions before that they're going through. So it is a...
It would knock their confidence dramatically, and therefore making a phone call, making connection again. We were talking about the importance of connection. Surely connection must be a significantly important thing for somebody having this experience.
When they come in, anyone who comes into a prison goes through a receiving office, and they do a health check and a mental health check there. And my observations of that is that some of those people do a very good job and they're very observant. But again, what I'm willing to disclose at that moment, for many of us, our ability to really disclose at that moment a whole range of things is going to be compromised.
Well, we could be in shock.
Yeah.
People could be in shock, surely.
It's going to be, very compromised. Plus, there are other people around. There's a whole range of things about, so it's certainly not, Corrections does recognise its duty of care in that place, but it's the environment, it's the space, it's how we're reacting to it. Someone who's churned through many times, I've seen it, can be relatively relaxed in that space, but that's certainly not for everyone. Mm-hmm. And for others, really heightened emotions of anger, of betrayal, of a whole range of emotions.
Injustice.
That's right. All of that coming together, it can be a very, very difficult time. And that's why I say that remand particularly is difficult. And it's also, as I said, it's where we have a very large prison population at the moment. It's where we've seen the biggest increase. So there's real capacity issues. So being able to deal on this really individual basis with people with high complex needs, it's often compromised.
So who does the mental health checks? I mean, is it a psychiatrist, some sort of specialist?
So they will have both custodial officers and nurses who do those sorts of checks. I think that if they feel that there's a real, you know, there is a referral system, but sometimes there's also a real volume issue. And I think the ability to fall through that cracks, we already know, Sheldon, and we see it in these absolutely horrifying statistics today. We fall through the cracks when we're outside of the wire in the broader community. So it's very possible to fall within, out, you know, through the cracks here too.
And I mean, in mental health, disclosure is a major issue, isn't it? And we're not comfortable with disclosing our mental health because of all the discrimination and judgment and prejudice and that sort of thing. So if you're going into a new environment like a somewhat shocking environment of prison, do people disclose?
I mean, some people will disclose, but often people won't, and they may think that by disclosing they make themselves much more vulnerable. And I think there's a really gendered response around this as well. So for men to disclose as they're coming into an environment where they recognise or they believe that weakness will be damaging to them, so their ability to disclose in that environment makes it extremely difficult. Mm. You know, and as I said, you know, you've said it, Sheldon, it's difficult to disclose. We have very low disclosure rates for a whole range of things. This is not an environment that is conducive to that types of disclosure. So when I think about transformative justice and think about alternatives to that system, that is one of the real issues around the types of spaces where we are able to be seen for who we are, that our humanity is first and foremost acknowledged, that those spaces of people who are able to support us in a range of ways, where experience and knowledge, and often that is user knowledge, those are people who have experienced the system before, those are people that have experienced often very significant mental health events in their life, that their expertise is drawn upon to support those going through that system now.
So you're really talking about lived experience of incarceration and lived experience of mental health. Yes. And peer support, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, and really seeing it as peer support, yes, but expert support. And I think that's the, you know, that's the really important element, that largely when we've thought about those that have been users of the system, we think about them in terms of been able to give some level of support because they know what it's like, but it's the expertise that I'm really interested in. It's the knowledge that is generated under those conditions and the way that that knowledge can inform what we do going forward.
So you're looking, you're seeking far now friendly alternatives to incarceration. Are you're leading up to talking about those, because this is what you're saying is peer support or having experts around people with lived experience of incarceration, of mental health, drug use, addiction, that sort of thing. So are there any examples in New Zealand of far now friendly alternatives?
Well, I think the big thing around transformative justice is around that it must be at a community level. So there needs to be that individual one-on-one, but it must be at a community level. It's around a full level accountability and responsibility in society. It's around recognising where harm happens. If we know that harm is happening for very young children, then we have a moral and a community and a whānau and a responsibility to attend to it. So some of those things is that what we've got at the moment is a very punishment-centred system. It's a very punitive system. It doesn't address harm sufficiently, or the way that it addresses harms is when more harm is reproduced. So for me, it's around what I always like to think about, even in thinking about those alternatives, is what sort of society would we need to have that would make prison abolition possible? What sort of society do we need that decarceration would enhance community and individual flourishing rather than diminish it? And so one of the things there is just to think, do prisons enhance human flourishing and do they diminish harm? And at the moment, we couldn't say that on the evidence. We have extremely high recidivism rate. We have, it reproduces harm. People come in for things that may be relatively minor and are likely to churn through. And as they churn through, it's likely that that offending becomes more and more serious. So there's all of those issues. So when I think about the types of alternatives sort of globally in other places, there are certainly within, I think that there are spaces within our broader communities. What we've heard when we've gone around the country is that we know our people, but we're not, they just don't have the resources. The resources go into a whole range of different spaces. You know, we spend $1 billion locking people up every year. So there is what we call, you know, if you're really wanting to do is sort of a justice reinvestment. We actually have to think about where do we want to invest, and the need to invest in community, the need to invest. So we have seen it on the small scales, and you see it in elements around things as simple but as necessary as women's refuge and, you know, those sorts of elements. We see it within some that we've met earlier that have been dealing with, say, the Ruapehu initiative, for example, which is looking at whānau violence, about bringing couples together, working with people and working with whole families in very particular ways. So one of the big things is what can be scaled up. What are the things that we need to keep quite small and intense? And in San Francisco, there's been groups, Generation 5, which has particularly looked at the issue of sexual abuse and often even intergenerational sexual abuse. And that is around really high levels of accountability, but working with everyone involved. Often, it doesn't mean that you bring the person who's been harmed with the person. Restorative justice is not always bringing the harm and the harmee together,
right,
but it's ensuring that you are working with those people, working with them, supporting them, working them through.
Do we have sufficient resources to do this? Because when I'm thinking about, you know, the overhaul of the mental health and addiction system, I mean, at the moment, the system is broken. You know, the media are talking this morning about people who are suicidal being put in taxis and told to go home to a lonely place where they're on their own and probably, you know, the quality of accommodation is very poor. Well, what chance are those people got?
And the same in many cases when there's a mental health call, it's the police who arrive there.
Right.
And, you know, in some cases, some tragic cases, the escalation that's occurred because of that has meant
the person
has died.
The police are the crisis front line, yeah. I think, you know. The statistics of the involvement of police, and I understand that the police are getting mental health 101 sort of tuition or training. How extensive that is, I don't know.
Well, I don't think it's sufficient, and also that, you know, up to 50% of their calls can have a mental health element. So I think one of the things there that we really have to think about in terms of resourcing, now there is a huge issue around capacity and capability in terms of workforce development, and that's a real challenge to us. If we think about places like Finland or who went through a high level of decarceration, it was around shifting expertise in their workforce and much capacity and capability. If we think about Portugal that legalised all drugs for personal use, and they did that for a health reason. So that was one of their huge challenges in the early years of that. I mean, that's 17 years now since they legalised all drugs for personal use. They haven't legalised for distribution or other things, but for personal use. And that was because they wanted to be able, they wanted to remove the barriers for people accessing health care. And so it meant a real shift from this sort of punitive space into a therapeutic space, and that cannot happen overnight.
Right.
But again, if you think about that resourcing, as I said, the we've seen the largest increase in funding increases goes into corrections as compared to health, as to compared to even education. So there is something about the levers that we pull. If we're spending over $100,000 per prisoner every year. Mm. If you think about the communities where prisoners are largely taken from, and these communities are often characterised by scarcity and deprivation, what would happen if you reinvested that money back into spaces like that? This is a really complex, difficult one. If it was simple, we would have done it.
Mm.
So it does demand a lot of us, and it demands, you know, but the thing around resourcing, we have to be really clear that we spend a lot of money already in a whole range of places. Are we spending it where we should spend it?
You talk about capacity and capability. Are you referring to having to find people to train in order for them to become nurses and therapists and support people and peer support?
I think all of that. I think that's obviously very important. I think it's, you know, significant in terms of, and also the type of thing that we want, people who are culturally informed care workers who actually know the context where people come in, that whilst we recognise the individual is important, that it's really important to know the collective and structural issues as well that are in place, because that's the communities we come out of. But there's also around that resourcing to support community, to ensure that there's flourishing, to ensure that there are places of beauty that people can go to recognise, you know, how do you uphold the dignity of a person in their day-to-day lives? There's something around, you know, the greening of spaces is seen as important. The beautification of spaces is seen important. So when we're thinking therapeutic, it's not always just solely in a health space, but it's largely about what are the real features in our community that would help us flourish. You know, in 2012, I was co-chair of the Children's Commissioner's Expert Advisory Group on Solutions to Child Poverty. And through that, you know, children were spoken to. We spoke to lots and lots of people as we did them, but there was also this group of children that was spoken to. And it was really interesting because they also saw housing, you know, as one of the really important features. But children said, you know, they wanted a place where they could play that was beautiful. You know, and it was such a... And that was just one child. There were children that talked about, you know, they wanted a place where they could be children and they could be valued as children.
Are we well endowed with beautiful places? I mean, all our volcanic mountains seem to be accessible to us because they are protected spaces. They add, don't they, a beautification resource to a city like Auckland?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a beautiful... Yeah, this is the thing about, again, that when you look at our statistics and you think just even the natural beauty that we have in New Zealand, but even around that thing around access and your right to those sorts of things, those are really important spaces. So if we look at some of our more deprived suburbs, you know, that sort of thing around the greening of those spaces and just particular types of amenities. And, you know, we've seen, I remember going to libraries as a child, Sean, and I think you did too. They were places of great quiet. And even as a child, They were, you know, people sort of saw the demise of the library. You think about libraries now. You go into any library. One, the silence thing is gone, but they're full. They're real hubs of community. And you see real high levels of diversity because of people going through. And there is something about the use of public amenities as well, and public spaces, and the need for collective security in public spaces, that is all a part of this way that we think around this issue. Because, you know, if we're going to make connections, you know, that's what makes community strong, is the ability to make connections in a whole range of different spaces and places, that I can be who I am in a space that is going to uphold my ability to be that person.
Well, it's lovely that you used the example of libraries, because my son took me along with the two grandchildren and his partner to the Te Aritu Library, and they had a wonderful free session there with music and books and the librarian blowing bubbles over the children and them capturing it. I've got some lovely photographs, and, you know, what a wonderful little session that was in terms of bringing parents and children together. Absolutely lovely. Well, let's take another music break. We're playing The Dudes, a New Zealand band that got back together in 2006, and this track is called Right First Time. Well, this is Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and I'm host Shelton Brown. Today we have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Tracy McIntosh about the overhaul of the criminal justice system. We'll go back into prison, Tracy. In the break there, you were talking about seclusion, which is a very controversial issue in mental health, in acute psychiatric care, and there is a move to try and eliminate seclusion by 2020. I think the one of the commissions, the Health and Safety Commission, has got a drive on, which I'm sure you would know about, mm-hmm. but I don't think they're going to achieve that goal by next year, judging by Dr. John Crawshaw's report on the incidence of seclusion in psychiatric care. But you were saying that it's very, very common in prisons.
Well, I think the thing is really seeing the crossover between within in mental health institutions and in prisons. So in New Zealand as a whole has very high level use of seclusion, has a high level use of restraints, and it's certainly that's very high within the psychiatric, you know, world. And as I said, there's a real sort of, it goes over into our prison environment as well. And so the question I guess I ask myself and we need to ask of each other is, again, why in New Zealand do we have higher than global, you know, when we look at the global indicators elsewhere, why are our seclusion rates so high, both in psychiatric and within within corrections? Why is the use of restraint high? And in fact, often in the psychiatric space, the use of compulsory orders is also very high, and particularly high for Māori. And in fact, when we look at Māori women, also, you know, incredibly high. So there's just something about the sorts of things. So there has been things around the use of seclusion. You know, we go back to Charles Dickens, you know, when he went on his tour of America, you know, we're going back a long time, talked about the psychiatric impact. You know, he did this whole big tour of the US, and one of the things he looked at was their prison system and the use of seclusion. And he, you know, he documents there about what seclusion produces and how quickly when one is pulled out that we lose sense of time and space and a whole range of other elements about what happens. And again, largely a very anti-therapeutic.
Well, you lose
response.
connection.
And how quickly.
Right.
How quickly that's done. And so I think that the use of seclusion, which is often comes really strongly out of psychiatric environment, the use of seclusion in prison is something that needs to be very, very clearly looked at. And
what,
I think,
what is the definition of restraint in prison?
Well, restraint is used where often to pacify an individual. So there's a control and restraint. So that maybe there's an incident within a unit, for example, where some form of constraint has been used, and then if the person is highly agitated that they may keep a restraint on.
So you're saying that they would be...
What you would find within a psychiatric.
So that still happens in psychiatric care?
I mean, it certainly happens within prison care, and of course for it to happen, it doesn't meet the same sorts of codes as others, and there's something in the Act that allows it.
But are you saying that they could be strapped to a bed or something like that?
That could happen, and it has been documented.
That's archaic.
Yeah, and it has been documented. In fact, you know, what we do here, we have the Ombudsman's reports, we have the prison visitors' reports, and so particularly looking at restraint. Now, on the whole, restraint is, you know, they will be isolated incidents. But the issue of seclusion, I think, is more widespread. And it's just, again, it's just when you look at our system, why do we have just higher than we would expect to have? And again, it's, you know, when we look at these negative social indicators, you know, and I even using that term is in many ways a violence, because it renders invisible the actual experience of the things that we've been talking about today. So it's just getting a much better sense about what are the tools that we have that should be able to enable people, to help people. Yes, to take on the the issue of safety and of public safety. That's a very important consideration. We recognise that. But I had one person say to me, and it really sort of stuck with me, and they say, you know, they use safety all the time, but actually they've taken our safety. They've stolen our safety, and then it's used against us. And there is something about that. And again, it comes back to this notion, that wonderful, you know, about the bird, but around our ability of trust in the world. And what we do know is that anything like the use of restraints and seclusion, when it's used really inappropriately, our ability to trust the world is so compromised.
Well, if it's unjustly and unfairly imposed on us as well, and we don't get any say as to why we may have behaved to supposedly deserve some sort of restraint. So what's the nature of... restraint and...
Seclusion.
Seclusion. I just lost that word. But what's the nature of seclusion in a prison?
Well, I think it's usually a part of a punishment regime. And I think this is one of the areas where the mental health issues need to be very much in consideration. We need to be able to know and understand why people respond in the ways that they do. And so the fact is that where it is used as a part of a punishment regime as opposed to being used in another way.
You mean therapeutically?
Yeah, well, it's not a therapeutic space. So largely that has how it's been used. So, you know, if we think about in popular culture, it's about going into the hole. You know, there's all of those sorts of references about those people who are put into seclusion, into isolated environments. In many ways, it's about acts of separation. So there may be reasons why people, for personal safety and others, that people need to be separated from other people. There's a recognition of that. But I think that when it fits within a punishment regime, when we're using seclusion in that way as a part of it, so there's a whole range of things like being contained in your cell, for example, and the loss of privileges. You know, these are all elements of a punishment and rewards economy that works in a prison. So you can have CCs, which means confined to cell. That means you'll stay in your unit, but when the rest of the people are released, you stay in the cell, and that's part of a punishment regime.
I mean,
but seclusion is different from that.
Well, you see, that's what surprises me.
Seclusion's different from that.
I would have thought that seclusion would have been that you were left in your cell on your own. So you're taken out of your cell.
You're taken out of your unit.
Put into
another unit.
And is that seen as a punishment?
It's largely a part of a punishment regime. There may be other reasons, and some of those are health reasons. I mean, there are at-risk units within prisons, and they are a very different unit. So I'm not talking about seclusion within an at-risk unit.
Right.
An at-risk unit is different and has a feeling much more of a psychiatric institution.
So that seclusion room in prison or in a psychiatric unit, I've never quite determined, but is there a toilet there? Is there a bed? Or is it just a clear space?
I mean, that depends. Rooms without toilets are called dry rooms, and dry rooms are usually used for other types of things, particularly when there's a suspicion that contraband has been internally hidden.
Oh.
So you might have a dry room within that. There may be times, and you know, I don't have the sort of the operational knowledge to know where someone might be put in a room where there was a fear that the access to a toilet could be dangerous for that person.
Right.
But usually within our more modern prison system, seclusion would mean that you just go in a cell and you're just separate from others. So you might have an increased level of custodial officers with you, and you don't have interaction or much more limited interaction with other individuals within the environment. And you might have that for 5 days, so you might be given, it's a charge for 5 days, maybe. And as I said, that's much more likely to be part of a punishment regime.
So you say it might be a charge. It's sort of...
You get internal charges with a prison environment for a whole range of things.
Right. Well, unfortunately, Tracy, we're running out of time, so our producer is letting me know that we're coming up to deadline. So thank you very much. I hope that the Ministry of Justice, who I guess facilitated this and contacted Planet FM, I hope they're satisfied with what we've covered. I was sort of conscious of that. I tried to make it both positive and negative, but thank you very much for your time.
And I think that positive thing is where we have to absolutely see ourselves as these agents of change. And we made this thing, we can unmake it. Right. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Thank you. So just coming up this week on the 29th of August, there's a Family Whānau Participation Forum. It's called the Family Whānau Expo 2019. This is at the Windsor Park Cafe, 550 East Coast Road, Mairangi Bay. It starts at 5 p.m. on the 29th of August. That must be the Thursday. Windsor Park Cafe, presentations start about 6:30 and it closes at 8. And some of the people involved in this are Ember, the organisation that funds Take It From Us, CADS, Emerge Aotearoa, the Asian Health Services, Waitemata District Health Board, Equip and Supporting Families. So sounds like a great talk fest. You can RSVP on 09822 8756 or email debbie.crichton, C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N, at waitemata.dhb.government.nz. Just keep in mind that little saying, a bird sitting on a tree is never afraid of the branch breaking because her trust is not on the branch but on its own wings. Always believe in yourself. And coming up Glen Innes on the 12th of September, Thursday, Friday the 13th and Saturday the 14th is Shotbro. This is Rob Mokoraka, his comedy show Shotbro, Confessions of a Depressed Bullet. This is at Tioro, so Thursday the 12th of September at 7 p.m, Friday the 13th of September at 7 p.m, and you can go on Saturday the 14th at 2 p.m. It's a forum and light refreshments after each performance. So that's Shotbro at Tioro, you just check out Tioro. The name of this comedy show is Confessions of a Depressed Bullet by Rob Mokoraka. So that's been taken from us. We've got another session on the review of the criminal justice system next week, live on Take It From Us. Everybody that you run into.